So this is Casey Arnold with Vanness Feldman attorney Bob Nordhaus, and we are concluding the second portion of today's interview. It's approximately 11:50 a.m. on November 9th. So you've continued to maintain a sort of relationship with the Department of Energy because you've been called back at various times.
Yeah, well, it's sort of an involuntary relationship in some reason. I mean, I go to the Christmas party and so on, but one of the more bizarre aspects of being a DOE alum is that you're never free from DOE litigation. And I'd say about once every 18 months, there's some litigation blow-up which results in my receiving a summons for either a deposition or testimony in DOE litigation. And it's so it turns out to be pretty regular, and sometimes on, you know, when it's, let's see, the most recent, three most recent, I think, were a age discrimination case which arose out of during my tenure at DOE, and there was a lawsuit that where a guy who was younger than I was accusing me, saying that I failed to promote him because of his age. The court just ultimately dismissed it, but I had to testify in that case. Another case involved litigation arising out of the sale of a big oil field that DOE had owned in California, the Elk Hills field, and there was litigation between DOE and the owner, the co-owner of the field, Chevron, over their respective ownership rights in the field. And that litigation, the sale was in 1998. The litigation had dragged on for 10 or 11 years, and I was deposed on some issues relating to whether DOE had properly made properly determined DOE's rights in the field in an administrative proceeding. And my testimony was, well, I wasn't there then. The agreement laying all this out was drafted and signed after I left, so I can't help you very much, but I still had to spend a day telling them all of this. There was one where we had lost an ANEPA case in Idaho in 1995 and settled the case with Idaho. Settlement had fallen apart, and I was deposed, and I think ultimately had to testify on what we meant in the original settlement in 1995. So, as I said, the DOE work casts a long shadow, and who knows what will be next in the next few years. But anyway, we'll get back to the main thread here.
Okay, so you returned to Van Ness Feldman after 4 years out. What did it feel like to come back?
Well, it was, the firm had grown up a good deal in my absence. It was a larger firm with a more diverse practice at that point, and a bigger environmental practice, a larger FERC practice. We had a office in Seattle. From my point of view, I think the biggest difference was that one of the idiosyncrasies of working for the Clinton administration was that you had to sign a 5-year agreement that extended the normal 1-year period when you could not have contact with your former agency after you left to 5 years. And my former agency was DOE, and I think when I signed this thing at the beginning of my tenure, they hadn't decided that they would treat FERC as part of DOE, which it technically is, but as at the time I left, the Clinton administration had determined that I could not only not have contact with the folks at DOE I'd been working with, but I could not practice it. I could not have any contact, written or oral contact, on business matters with FERC, which meant that essentially I couldn't practice at FERC anymore. And I was a little grumpy about that, but it turned out to be a blessing in disguise, in that my practice took a, I do some FERC work now that the 5 years has expired, but my practice took a very different turn and much more focused on environmental law, and in particular on climate, but also Clean Air Act issues. And so I probably, in the last, well, now 15 years since I've been back, probably done much more environmental law work than anything else. And it's been very rewarding. So it's coming back, and so it meant that I couldn't just sort of step back into my prior practice, but that I had to develop a new and different practice, which I did with a number of our colleagues here. And it turned out to be a different kind of environmental practice, because we went out of our way to not only represent companies, but also we worked for a number of NGOs, and that's difficult to navigate from a conflicts point of view. But what we did, we ended up doing quite a bit of work for the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, what's now the Bipartisan Policy Center for the Energy Future Coalition, and for Pew, we did a number of reports for them on climate issues, some of which were a little controversial. For the other NGOs, we did a lot of legislative drafting work and sort of general advice on energy and environmental regulatory issues, which was a lot of fun. And then we had at the same time doing similar work for other clients. We managed to navigate the conflicts minefield by just telling clients on both sides that we had a wide-ranging practice and that we were consulting and advising clients that might have a different position on certain issues. What that meant under the DC bar rules was that we had limited ability to have a direct advocacy role on some issues, so we could go to the Hill as advisors but not as advocates on some issues on cap and trade and other environmental matters. But it turned out to be, you know, the environmental legislation never got anywhere, to my regret, but it turned out to be a very rewarding for us, and I think for the clients, way of approaching some of these very technical issues that came up in the context of cap and trade. And we did a lot of legislative drafting, a lot of sort of conceptual work. You know, how do you design a cap and trade program? The form, the latter reflected in work we did for Q and for the what's now the Bipartisan Policy Center. But I would say for me it was, you know, it was great not to be pushed back into the middle of a FERC practice, and it was, I think, quite a bit more interesting doing the environmental work than what we lovingly call FERC work. So the transition back, and you know, like you never, as you go into private practice either the first time or the second time, you never know whether you're going to have any business, who's going to retain you, whether, you know, if you go with a law firm that's got existing clients, obviously they can provide you with some work to keep you going. But I think the experience, my experience was that the people just sort of came out over, the stuff just came in over the transom, and was, you know, plenty to do, and it was interesting work. So it was quite rewarding, I think. One of the things that I got engaged in early on was asked to be a member of the Market Surveillance Committee for the California Independent System Operator, California ISO, which operated the transmission system and the energy markets in California. They were the first of those, the first ISO to be formed, and as it turned out, not the least successful, I should say. So the Market Surveillance Committee was supposed to keep an eye on the design and performance of the markets that the California ISO operated, which we did. We had determined that they were not competitive, and that there were major issues unless they changed the market structure. The market structure didn't get changed in time, and they had a total meltdown in California as a result of the way the markets were designed and the way FERC and the California PUCs regulated wholesale and retail electric power supply. But that was an extracurricular activity that I ended up doing, which was, I think, it was certainly interesting. And the California market, as you probably know, collapsed really, and they had to totally redo the regulatory system there. And it was interesting and unfortunate to be a witness to all of that. And I think, had they taken our advice early on, they might have avoided it, but they didn't.
So you said that while you were gone, the firm changed quite a bit structurally, and when you had arrived, it was really common for people to have spent time in government beforehand. Is that still the case? How do people sort of make their way to Van Ness Feldman now?
This is now, you know, when I arrived in 1980, it was essentially a startup operation. The firm had been founded in 1977. By the time I came back, it was a mature firm. I think there were maybe 50 lawyers at that point, and many of whom had come up very few hires off of Capitol Hill. Many of the lawyers who were partners or senior associates had come up through the ranks. Some of them had been hired from executive agencies, but the texture of the firm, if you will, it was much different because it was not dominated by people who had worked on the Hill, and much more sort of diverse base of people, which was probably good, but was, I think, a little, didn't have the same entrepreneurial spirit that the firm did when I first joined it. It was no longer a startup.
So looking back at your time at Van Ness Feldman as a whole now, what would you say have been some of your major accomplishments and the high points of your time here?
I was in charge of recruiting for many years, and I think one of the major, one of the major accomplishments was recruiting a bunch of associates who are now very productive partners. But it's hard, I think if I look back on I think our environmental work was path breaking. Though so far it's come to naught on the Hill, but it's hard. I think as a practicing lawyer, it's much harder to sort of look back at major milestones, or certainly for me, than looking back at what I did as a government lawyer, because there was much, seemed to be much more tangible stuff that came out of the government work than comes out of private practice.
Sort of going off a little bit of something that you said yesterday, you spent about 12 years here before you went back in with the Clinton administration, and you said that by that time you were starting to get a little restless and thinking about returning to government. So it's been 15 years now. How do you feel after this second stint here?
I'm not sure I could handle it. I'm now 75, and it's probably time to think about slowing down a bit. But I think that I've probably done what I'm going to do as a private practitioner. Whether I would go back, I don't think going back to government, I'm not sure I have the stamina for a full-time government job, but one thing I would consider at this point is expanding my teaching, which is an important part of what I do now. Maybe not working as hard.
So you've taught, I believe, at Georgetown and also at George Washington.
Yeah, so I taught 5 years at Georgetown. This is adjunct capacity. Taught an energy law course for 3 or 4 years, and then a legislative and regulatory drafting course. And at GW, I've been teaching there now for 11 years, and we've tried to set up an energy law program there. Started out teaching an energy law course, and then we found that we were doing so much environmental law in the energy law course that we split the course, and so there's a fall course, which is what I call Energy Law 101, which a couple of my colleagues teach, and then a spring course, which is energy and environmental law, that I teach with a former DOE colleague. And what we're trying to do is to develop a much more expansive energy law program at GW Law School. Try to have a program that is more than just two survey courses and covers areas of energy law in much greater detail.
What do you enjoy most about teaching law?
What I like about it, and this sounds a little selfish, I guess, but teaching it's a if you have to teach a subject, it's a, particularly if you're a practitioner, it's a way of sort of organizing how you look at your own field, which as a practitioner you really don't do. I mean, you do this and you do that, or and as a government lawyer too, you're always, you know, as a practitioner, it's you work on whatever a client brings to you. As a government lawyer, you're working on whatever the agency happens to be doing at the time, but you never get a, in either capacity, an overview of the area of law that you're practicing. And I think, to me, one of the most valuable things from teaching is it gets you to organize your knowledge and thinking about your own field. And I like just, you know, once I get it organized, trying to transmit it in some coherent form to the folks in the class. What we found is that we have a very bright group, and there we do a paper course in the current course, and I end up learning a lot from our students, which in areas that I, you know, we had like last class, like 3 or 4 papers on fracking, which I'd never paid much attention to, international law issues, because of the, particularly teaching in Washington, you have a lot of students who are not just fresh out of college and going to law school because they don't know what else to do with themselves, but who have worked in the private sector or in government for a number of years, or who may be working part-time as they go through law school, and they have quality of experience and insight into some of these issues that makes it a lot of fun to have them in class. And so I find that particularly rewarding, just to have a group of students who know more about some stuff than I do. And,
How do you feel like law students today are different than law students when you were one?
Well, first of all, law school is so expensive now that they're totally preoccupied by how to repay their student loans. And they don't have the luxury of saying, all right, well, I'll finish law school and take a year off and travel to Tibet. They're very focused on where law school takes them, how to get, you know, where to find a job, where to find work they want to do, figuring out what they want to do. And I think that, you know, compared to, you know, this is a much different law student population than the Yale Law School student population, in that I think they're much more, Yale Law School's always been much more focused on clerkships and teaching, becoming law teachers and deans than the typical law school. And so you have, I think, a group of students who are much, much more focused on getting a law firm or government job just to support themselves than what I saw when I was going through law school, and probably, you know, where you had, it's where law, the, you know, getting to, you know, the financial burden of going through law school didn't cripple you for much of the rest of your life.
So over the last 2 decades, a lot has changed about sort of just the practice of law generally. So how have the different areas in which you've practiced changed throughout your career?
Well, I think the, you know, it goes without saying that the legal profession we see today is a much different profession than it was certainly when I graduated from law school, or even when I went into private practice. The whole scale of the scale of law firms is, you know, I think when I entered private practice, the biggest law firm in the country had maybe 200 lawyers. Now it has 2,000 or more. Lawyers' compensation is, you know, at the high end is much greater than anybody would have conceived of 30 or 40 years ago. The competitiveness of law practice is, you know, the competitiveness and the professional pressures on associates and partners in most law firms make law practice, I think, a good deal less rewarding personally than it was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. Our firm has tried to resist most of that, I think, successfully, and in that this is the way I put it anyway, what we're trying to do is not maximize profits per partner, but to maximize professional satisfaction. And so we're trying to have a firm where partners do the work they want to do, they're able to recruit clients who don't necessarily pay us at our standard rate. They get, you know, our compensation system's designed to reflect partner performance, but we're not requiring, if people want to take home less money and represent less lucrative clients, that's fine. Want them to do the work that interests them and that they find personally rewarding. So it's we've tried to keep, tried to maintain a collegial and low pressure kind of law practice that has turned out to be both fun and financially rewarding enough that nobody seems to want to go elsewhere.
I don't know if this was a common saying when you were at Yale Law, but nowadays people sort of say that at Yale Law they train you for your last job and not your first. Do you feel like that was true, and how do you feel that Yale Law prepared you for your different?
Yale Law certainly, I'm not sure I realized it at the time, but Yale Law certainly trained me for my first job in that, for instance, you know, much of the work, constitutional law was a sort of central part of our work in the Legislative Council's office, because every time we drafted a statute, we'd have to look and see, assure ourselves that there was a constitutional basis for it. What I did in my third year in law school, which was to focus on economic regulation, particularly of the oil industry, turned out to be the area that I ended up working in really for the rest of my life. Still do. It's economic regulation now morphed into, there was no environmental regulation, and now and actually environmental regulation as it goes to market-based, using market-based tools becomes more and more a form of economic regulation. But I think training or exposure to economic regulation and really to Robert Bork's thought on economic regulation ended up serving me very well, though it was probably five or six years after law school before I actually got into it. But I think, so it certainly helped me in my first job, second job, third job, fourth job. I don't think Yale Law School really focused on training people for a lot of skills that are important in private practice. And I think the theory then and now is that those skills you could pick up. What law school is for is getting yourself oriented in the legal system and understanding the larger context of legal disputes and legal issues. And there, it was that to me was very important, the ability to be able to take any problem and sort of figure out, sort of orient myself in the framework of existing law that the problem confronted, and figuring out how to, particularly in the legislative drafting context, but also in the policy context, which is really what I do now, what changes are necessary to make the law work in the direction that we want it to work. And I think Yale, and when I was there, really looked at law as an instrument of social policy, or some at least some at the law school did. And I think that, for what I ended up doing for most of my professional life was quite important, because essentially the drafting and policy work on the Hill and in government was really, as a government lawyer, was really how to use statutes and regulations to advance social goals in the larger sense. Whether it be environmental or economic, tax.
So you're coming up on the 50th anniversary of your graduation from Yale Law. Right. Which means that you're also coming up on your 50th anniversary of starting your law career. So what does being a lawyer mean to you, and how is that, is it anything like what you expected?
I'm not sure I had a very clear expectation at the time I graduated from law school, and so I knew what my father's small town law practice was like. That wasn't what I was interested in. Had no idea what being a lawyer in the House of Representatives was going to be like. Very sort of dim idea of what private practice would be like. A even dimmer idea of what working as a lawyer in the executive branch would be like. So I'm not sure. I don't think I had very clear expectations as to what law practice would be like. So it's, very hard to say in retrospect that what actually happened was congruent with what I expected. I guess what I would say is that the experience has been what I actually did was nothing I had planned to do, but partly because I had no very coherent plan, but to the extent I did, I don't think it would have would have encompassed spending the years on the Hill, the years in the regulatory agencies, and then coming back to DOE after 12 years of private practice and dealing with that rather bizarre institution.
Outside of your legal career, what have been some of your greatest accomplishments, and what else are you really passionate about?
Well, I have, professionally, the teaching's important. The time on the Market Surveillance Committee was, I thought, interesting. And I wish we'd have been able to have more influence on what ultimately occurred. Then I have a bunch of extracurricular interests, hiking, trekking, skiing, sailing, which are quite important to me, but I'm not sure are central to this interview.
What do you feel are some of the biggest energy and environmental issues that are currently facing America? You've written a lot lately on the Clean Air Act.
Well, I think... I think first of all, climate. Of course, what's interesting is that the U.S. is, probably by inadvertence, making significant progress on reducing its greenhouse gas emissions, at least for now, through serendipity or misfortune of the combination of recession and the massive switch from coal to natural gas and the improvement in automotive fuel economy. But I think globally that's the a major issue we've got to come get a handle on. I think we're in a sort of period of major transition in the energy industry, and for 40 years now we've been sort of whining about dependence on imported oil, having adequate fuel choices, trying to diversify our energy supply, and suddenly through a set of technological changes our oil use is declining and our oil consumption is oil production is increasing, so we're much less dependent on imported oil, and we have this large buffer of the strategic oil reserve. So we're sort of stepping, I think it's in the energy policy area, sort of stepping back and saying, well, what does all this mean? We're awash in natural gas, our oil production's increasing. What is it we should be trying to do? And I don't think there's a coherent policy formula that people have figured out at this point. We're now at a much different, the policy formula for coming out of the embargo was arrest the decline in U.S. oil production, decrease imports, increase energy efficiency, have a buffer stock of oil in case there's another embargo, rely on coal because natural gas is very scarce, rely on nuclear for the same purpose. And the predicate of these policies looks like it's about to be swept away. So I don't think we really know where we're going on energy policy. And I think energy policy more and more is going to be dictated by environmental policy. And there I think we have a clear but controversial path, which is to reduce the health risks from conventional pollutants, and reduce the planetary risks from greenhouse gases. The latter is much more an issue for countries other than the U.S., than the U.S. at this point, where our greenhouse gas emissions are declining and are likely to continue to decline for a number of years. But much of the developing world, and even in Europe, they're probably going to increase, as Europe, particularly as Europe goes away from nuclear power and back to fossil energy.
Perhaps you do offer these people advice on occasion, but if you could offer advice to the individuals that are in some of your old government positions, what would you tell them?
It's a good question. I think I'd start with, you know, let's figure out what our objectives are on energy policy and what our opportunities are from the point of view of changing the resource base to less carbon intensive energy sources, and try to focus on how to take advantage of these technological breakthroughs that have occurred sort of under our noses without necessarily our figuring it out as it happened, but how to take advantage of these technological breakthroughs and changes in energy markets to both improve our economic standing, to improve public health, and reduce carbon emissions.
Having now spent several years in both government and private practice, do you prefer one field to the other, or?
Well, government, you know, the government work is, it's certainly more interesting and challenging. The problem is it's sometimes a little too challenging because I think the personal toll, there's so much going on. It's so much, the personal demands of government work are such that most people can only take it in limited doses. But if you can handle it, I think it's much more rewarding.
A lot has changed over the course of your career, and some of that has been change that you've helped to affect. Do you feel like the work, it's easier to be effective as a private practice attorney or easier to be effective as a government attorney?
Well, I'm not sure either can be very effective right now. In other words, one of the concerns for anybody in government is that government has managed to paralyze itself. And so that much of what you would do as a government lawyer comes to naught. It's either lost, you know, you're working on legislation that never gets enacted, or rulemakings that don't pass muster in judicial review, or never see the light of day because they're vetoed by OMB. So I think in private practice, particularly in Washington, can you see me?
Yeah.
Private practice is, in many respects, rewarding if you have a functioning government, which we don't have right now. So that I think there's a great deal of frustration both in the public sector and the private sector arising from the fact that our federal establishment has effectively paralyzed itself. Now, all of this may change, you know, in the second Obama administration. Hope springs eternal. I would be a little skeptical that Congress and the federal government are going to be very much more effective in the next 4 years than they were in the last 4 years.
Did you ever feel that any of the work that you did as a private practice attorney conflicted with anything that you've done as a government attorney?
Not really. Basically, particularly as an advocate, I'm not very good advocating something I think is stupid. So to the extent that I think the stuff we did in government was sensible, trying to undo it is something I would have difficulty advocating, and just because I'm not a very good advocate of stuff that I think that I don't believe in. So I think for the most part, just sort of as a visceral reaction to things that come along, I don't feel comfortable taking on stuff that would, even if it's not a technical conflict, and there are all kinds of rules relating to, you know, both bar rules and government ethics rules relating to taking on work that's contrary to what you did in government. So you can't, you're trying a case for the government, you can't switch sides and in the same case and go the other way, but that's both a criminal violation and a violation of the bar rules. But you frequently, if you're talking about a rulemaking or legislation, there are no bar rules or government ethics rules which preclude you from undoing legislation you worked on while in government. But I guess my personal view is that it's not something I would want to do if I thought the legislation was sensible when enacted and still made sense.
Speaking of ethics, have there been any points in your career where you felt ethically compromised in any way?
Well, I've certainly tried to avoid it, and I try to, you know, and I think I've been fairly successful in avoiding successful in avoiding ethical challenges, but there have been numerous circumstances where I've had to be very careful, and I've tried to tried over the years to, you know, not get too close to the edge on these things.
You've worked on some pretty big things as a government attorney. Do you feel, and did you feel when you were working on these things, that the government work that you were doing was more important than work that you were doing here? How do you feel?
Well, at the time, you know, the time I was working on legislation or regulations when I was in executive branch agencies, I thought the stuff was pretty important, and I think it was. In private practice, it's rare that you have an opportunity to actually do something of major, do something that's good for your client, may incidentally affect some major change in law or policy, but your objective is to help your client, not save the world. And my experience is that you have very few opportunities in private practice to save the world. And some of the stuff we've done for NGOs, where we're trying to work out the basic mechanics of a cap and trade system, for instance, I thought was pretty rewarding and important, not sure the rest of the world thought that, but the typical, I think private practice tends to be much more granular and narrowly focused than the government work.
Do you have any professional regrets?
I'm very sorry that I didn't get appointed to the Supreme Court, but aside from that, no. That's kidding. It was I'm very sorry. I never made it to the U.S. Open in tennis. Of course, I didn't even play tennis. But the major regrets. I think they're, most of these opportunities one I've had anyway have come and I've been able to take advantage of them. I'm not sure that there are major things I could have done but didn't do. In California, the Market Surveillance Committee work, I wish we had been able to be more forceful about the problems with the California market. But I thought we were pretty forceful, just nobody paid attention. I don't think I have major regrets about, like in the Clean Air Act, there's some drafting things that I wish I had figured out at the time, but you can't figure everything out.
You mentioned maybe starting to think about slowing down a little, and you talked a little bit about your teaching, but what are sort of the goals for the rest of your career?
I'd like to do more writing. I'd like to do more teaching. I'd like to do more NGO work. I'd probably just loll around a little bit more.
And one of the reasons you came to D.C. coming out of Yale Law was because you thought that it would be really exciting. Is D.C. still exciting?
It's more frustrating than exciting right now. No, I'd say for a lawyer, if I were coming out of Yale Law School now, I'd think seriously about, I don't think I'd think Washington, identify Washington as an exciting place to work now, but I don't know the current breed of law students regards as exciting, but it's right now very frustrating, frustrated at the current political stalemate makes it very, very difficult to do anything useful in Washington right now. So I have plenty of time to do oral histories.
That is the end of my questions. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that covers it. Anyway, it was a sort of a interesting exercise to get questioned about a 50-year stint in Washington, which it's hard to realize that it's been almost that long. And I really intended to stay here only a few years and then go off and do something else. And here I am.
Well, great. Thanks so much.
Okay,
it's been
thank you.
Great.
Great questions.